This is the takeaway for Thursday, May 11th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Among the fallout from the firing of former FBI Director James Comey are calls for some form of independent investigation into the circumstances of Comey's dismissal and of alleged ties between Donald Trump and Russia. It's all grown louder.
We need to have a special prosecutor to look into all of these ties. That is why we have to figure out what has happened here. And I believe we should also have an independent commission.
That's Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar speaking yesterday. And here's a contrarian White House Deputy Press Secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
We don't think it's necessary. You've got a House committee, a Senate committee, and the Department of Justice all working on this.
And here's Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General who wrote the memo that brought down Comey, who said during his confirmation hearings in early March that he was willing to consider a special counsel in certain scenarios.
I'm willing to appoint a special counsel, Senator, whenever I determine that it's appropriate based upon the policies and procedures of the Justice Department.
Of course, Congress will decide, and we welcome Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York back to The Takeaway. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Great. Comment on your colleague, Senator Klobuchar, who says we need a commission or an independent counsel here. What do you think?
I agree with her. I think we need an independent special counsel now. I think it's important that we have this special prosecutor to do a in-depth, independent investigation. I think the American people don't have faith in the process, given that President Trump just fired our FBI director. I also think a special commission is also something that makes a lot of sense. The 9/11 Commission did an in-depth investigation. It takes many years to do that, so I think you should have both.
Although this doesn't have the severity of 9/11, do you think?
I think this is a very serious issue that could have those similar implications. It's not a terrorist issue, but it's one that could have constitutional implications. And so I think the investigation must be done. It's really outside the norm for President Trump to have fired the FBI director when there's an ongoing investigation into his campaign and colleagues. I think it's something certainly that I've never seen done and is really undermining people's confidence that justice will be done in this case.
You're certainly right that it's unusual to fire an FBI director. But in this particular case, Trump does have a point that Democrats and Republicans were reviling him for various reasons right up until the dismissal.
Well, I think people would understand this action if he did it 3 months ago. But given that he praised the investigation of Hillary as a candidate and up until he became president, it's very bizarre that now 3 months later, when he's asking for more resources, when Commissioner Comey is actually asking for more resources to do his job in the investigation, for him to be fired now, it just smacks of not only insincerity, but that this is not what that his stated rationale is not accurate.
Do you expect him to appoint someone who will be a Trump yes man in the case of the Russia investigations? Don't we have confidence, given the Senate's ability to confirm such a nominee, that we will have someone who will do exactly what you say?
Well, so far, I have not had great confidence in the people President Trump has appointed, and very few have I even voted for. I have not seen independence in his cabinet. And I have not seen independence in the people around him. So I don't have a lot of faith that he'll appoint somebody independent.
Who would you suggest?
I don't think we're in a position now to decide who should be the next FBI director. I think we should be talking about having a special prosecutor.
Who should do that job then?
Well, we can look at who's appropriate and considered independent. And I'm sure there'll be a parlor game around Washington to do that. But I think this president needs to commit to hiring a special prosecutor to do the job. I voted specifically against Rod Rosenstein because he wouldn't say that he would name an independent prosecutor to do this job. And so I think what the president needs to do is show leadership and call for an independent prosecutor.
You would say independent prosecutor more than an independent commission?
I think the prosecutor is urgent and necessary now because there was an ongoing investigation into at least three of President Trump's campaign workers, the head of the campaign and two other senior advisors in the campaign. And so that investigation needs to be completed now. A commission is going to take 2 or 3 years. They're very, very in-depth, very long-standing commissions that take time. So I think you need a prosecutor, and if you want to do a longer-term review, you should do it as well. I think having another country hack our election is so serious, and we need to get to the bottom of it before the next election in 18. And so that investigation needs to be completed now, and we need to be able to hold Russia accountable.
But that investigation still is going on within the FBI. Everyone says that.
Well, we hope. Certainly several people have said this has such a chilling effect, and that certain individuals have said that this is something that was sending a message to people at the FBI that you better be careful. And I think that's hugely problematic.
You mentioned the selection of a special prosecutor or the selection of new personnel here that would satisfy precisely these serious concerns that you've raised would be something of a parlor game in Washington. And I think a lot of Americans go, yeah, could we get around to doing the tax cut? Could we get around to doing health care? Could we stop the parlor games now?
This investigation is not a parlor game. This investigation is the most serious allegation about an administration who's trying to be above the law and subvert justice because it's being investigated. It is a serious issue that should not be demeaned or reduced to a joke. This is something that is really important, and I think the American people should stand up, demand action, demand a special prosecutor, and not give up about this, because this is something that is reminiscent of earlier times when presidents believe they're above the law. No president is above the law.
Kirsten Gillibrand is the U.S. Senator from the state of New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Special prosecutors, independent commissions, what kind of powers do they have? How much of a distraction to the government can they be? Robert Ray, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel for the Clinton Whitewater investigation. He's currently in private practice. Ray says the role of these super prosecutors, who all inherit a piece of the Nixon Watergate history, has evolved greatly away from their original intent and mission.
Well, I think in a perfect world, it was intended to be temporary. That was the way the statute was constructed. The problem was that in practice, you know, on one side, the administration saw to its advantage, and certainly criminal defense lawyers saw to their advantage in Washington, D.C., to do whatever they could essentially to sort of run out the clock and delay the investigation in the hopes that, you know, public sentiment would turn, which is ultimately what happened in many of the investigations. From a prosecutor's
public
perspective,
sentiment got tired of the whole thing under
right.
Clinton.
It was expensive. It interfered with the operation of the executive branch. There may have been cause to put an independent counsel in place, but the idea was under the statute, the command was a prompt, cost-effective, and responsible investigation. And the difficulty with that is that that's nice to put down on a piece of paper. But remember, an independent counsel statute starts with a commission, which is a piece of paper, and nary a paperclip. I mean, you have to build an office separate from the department with agents, prosecutors, desks, pencils, erasers, notepads, a travel corps. I mean, everything that you would do in order to set up what amounts to a mini Department of Justice separate and apart from the Department of Justice.
Right.
Now, the ramp-up time for that alone, in my experience, was probably a year.
Wow.
And that year is a year that the public, their perspective is, you know, independent counsel Kenneth Starr or Robert Ray or whoever it's been in office now a year, and well, what do they have to show for it?
Right. So there's an argument that could be made that Donald Trump looks at Comey – sees a kind of mess of investigations. He also sees Democrats don't like him. Republicans don't like him. His impulse is, well, let's get rid of the guy. Do you think that's a reasonable argument that we don't need an investigative arm of the Justice Department, a special prosecutor, because there's a consensus? He had to go.
I think that part of that ignores history. I mean, understand that in the wake of J. Edgar Hoover, Congress addressed the question of what should the term of an FBI director be. And it's a very unusual feature of the executive branch that you have a person fill the position for a term of 10 years. Why 10 years? It was intended to be a position filled that would be, in that sense, elevated out of partisan politics and extend beyond the term of any one president.
You've read the Rosenstein memo, right?
I have.
And he's been in office 2 weeks.
Yes.
All right.
And we served together. I mean, I know Rosenstein very well.
Does that memo justify the removal
of an FBI director, do you think, given what you've just said about the 10-year term and the extent to which we're trying to get out of the politicization of the FBI director?
Well, it can, and I think it serves as a reminder, again, taking it out of the present circumstance. Certainly it is the case that when an FBI director or any executive branch official travels outside of their lane, so to speak, and I think, you know, there are people, reasonable people can differ about whether Jim Comey had cause to do that or not, but I don't think there's any question that the circumstances led him to conclude by his own testimony that he needed to travel out of lane, given the fact that the then Attorney General Loretta Lynch, in his opinion and in the opinion of many people, had been compromised as the result of the Clinton investigation and her meeting with President Bill Clinton on the plane on the tarmac in Arizona. That he made a call. Now the problem with that, once you travel out of lane, left to the next administration, which is clearly contemplated by the fact that the FBI director serves for a term of 10 years, you travel out of lane with one administration. It seems to me a logical fear from the next administration
that
you might well travel out of lane in the next administration as to them. And so that, you know, there's no question that's an issue.
Looking at everything here, do we need a special prosecutor to investigate what's happened here?
My own view of that is that you have to be careful about appointing a special prosecutor under whatever iteration we're talking about. Now, historically, I think experience has shown that it should be reserved for the most extraordinary of situations. It is a very bad message to the public to conclude, unless absolutely necessary, that the Department of Justice is not capable of conducting a fair, thorough, and independent investigation, wherever the facts may lead, to decide whether prosecution is warranted. Now, what the department is not really equipped to do, and is really more a job for Congress, is to be fact gatherers. That's not your job as a prosecutor. My job as a prosecutor was not to gather facts and inform the public about what it is I find. That's the mission of Congress. I gather facts in order to decide a very limited mission that is reserved for extreme conduct, and that is conduct that warrants prosecution. And that's why there's, you know, equal talk about whether or not a commission is the more appropriate forum. That's what Congress is supposed to do and does best. Now, historically, there have been problems with that, because if you send Congress on the mission to gather facts, one of the obstacles to that is the fact that people potentially have criminal liability. And smart criminal defense lawyers, as is in the case now with regard to Michael Flynn, have made the argument, look, my client may have some things to say, but he's not going to say them unless you grant him immunity.
Which is the Oliver North situation.
And the Oliver North situation is a problem. And we have learned in the wake of Oliver North and court decisions, if once given immunity, it effectively disables or potentially disables the criminal process thereafter. So, you know, fact gathering comes at a price. You can get the facts, but if you do so, you render a referral more difficult later on if you find that the facts warrant a referral for criminal prosecution. That's a dilemma, and I don't know that there's an easy solution to that. You know, you can have a special prosecutor or the Department of Justice in the ordinary course conduct a criminal investigation, and simultaneously Congress can look into that. But there are consequences in the overlap.
Robert Ray, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation. He's currently a partner at Thompson and Knight. Thank you so much.
Nice to be with you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Somali-American children in Minnesota are experiencing a serious measles outbreak. The state has the largest Somali population in the U.S., and health officials say they believe the outbreak was created by anti-vaccine groups targeting Somali communities, getting them to refuse to immunize their children. Yesterday, the state's health commissioner has called for a $5 million emergency fund to help fight the outbreak. From Minnesota Public Radio Studios, Kristen Erisman, director of the Infectious Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health, made a blunt accusation.
Our Somali population has been targeted by the anti-vaccine groups at a time when they were vulnerable, when they were very concerned about autism in their community. And that targeting and misinformation has resulted in direct reduction in immunization coverage levels, and I think this outbreak.
Well, let's talk first of all about what the argument would be from these anti-vaccine groups to the Somali community in particular, that would be persuasive. You mentioned a sensitivity to autism. describe?
Well, in the year 2000, there was an observation that Somali students were enrolled in the special education program in the Minneapolis public schools at a higher rate than other racial or ethnic groups. And there was actually a story done in the media about that. And once that came out, that sort of word that, you know, autism was higher in the Somali community really took hold. And so the community was very, very concerned about issues of autism. And right from the very beginning, right after that came out, the Department of Health hosted a forum for the community to talk about concerns about autism, concerns about immunization. And even at that very first forum, the anti-vaccine groups were present. And what we see when we look at immunization rates is that prior to 2008, the immunization rates for the Somali community were at or above those for the rest of the children in Minnesota. And then after 2008, we saw this precipitous drop-off. Each year, we saw more and more kids not receiving the MMR vaccine. And right now, the coverage in this population is at 41%.
Mm. I mean, it's not against the law, but if you're essentially telling people to do something that has the net effect of causing a disease to spread within that community, what do you do about that?
Well, certainly we feel strongly that what has been done in this community is wrong. And we have worked with the community over the years to try and address this. And I think that as a public health community, we have refined our outreach and our collaboration with the community to a point where I think that what we're doing now in these last, you know, few years is the right message and the right approach. We just lack the resources and sort of scalability. So we have a Somali outreach worker whose job it is to work on normal child development and helping parents understand, you know, what milestones they should be expecting to see with their children. And then we also have an outreach worker who's focused on, you know, immunizations. One of the challenges is the fact that the Somali community has an oral tradition, and so you really need to be reaching out to people individually and talking to them. So handing out a fact sheet or putting up a billboard is not sufficient. And that approach is a fine one. It's just exceptionally labor intensive. And, you know, we just have felt that we haven't had the resources to be able to direct to the community that we would have liked to be able to target this misinformation.
Kristen Ehrsman is director of the Infectious Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What do you think of an experienced modern dancer saying that she has suddenly found a deep reservoir of creativity? Now, what do you make of that dancer insisting that finding that creative mission meant she also had to lose her legs forever?
It's almost as if a whole box of creative opportunities has been opened since I've been disabled, just having to problem solve constantly. So although I may not be able to extend my legs or leap like I used to, I think I have grown a lot in my creative thinking as a dancer.
2.5 years ago, Karina Ho received a spinal cord injury in an accident that also killed her mother. In her grief, she learned that her body would always need a wheelchair to move with speed and grace. Karina is now a full-time dancer with a company called Axis, which also sees that having both able-bodied and disabled dancers on stage together is a dazzling creative enterprise that affirms the idea of being an artist and a human. I met Karina, who's 29, last week out in California and discovered an artist with her wheels, not her toes, on the ground, but a young artist just taking off.
Movement is incredibly important. That's kind of the crux of life for me. My injury occurred only 2.5 years ago, and having lived 26 years of my life as a very active person, as a dancer, I knew nothing about wheelchair dance. So coming into this, I started at Axis Dance as an apprentice originally, and it took me a while to embrace that. At first, I was very resistant. I was like, wheelchair dancing, not being able to leap and pirouette and do tendus and all these things that I used to be able to do, that's not dancing. But over time, as I've discovered more range in my body and the grace and the power that I still possess, I've been able to really come to love it.
What do you remember of your accident? Anything?
I remember the whole thing. I was in a car with my whole family. We were on a family road trip. It was actually the last day of the trip. And a semi-truck came up from behind us and rear-ended us. And I was the only person who maintained consciousness. So I remember the force of the impact. And
what was that like?
It was like just being thrown so quickly and so with so much force that you couldn't even move. You couldn't resist it. It was like a blur. And time slowed down. And I remember looking around and just seeing my family once the car had come to a stop. And that was pretty devastating.
Well, you lost some of your family.
Yeah, I did. The outcome of the accident just utterly devastated my family. However, we've been able to really stick together. And although some of us came out with severe injuries, lifelong permanent disabilities, we've been able to move on. And for me, the arts, music, and dance have been like my lifeline into recovery.
You say you were conscious during the accident before and after. Were you conscious of your own injury?
I remember feeling like the lower half of my body was like jelly. I was flopping around. I had no idea why, though, but I was at the time more concerned with what was going on with my other family members. So it wasn't until I probably about 10 minutes into realizing that the accident happened that I looked down and realized that I couldn't move my legs. And I remember telling the 911 responder that I couldn't move my legs. And that was a terrifying moment.
When you were able-bodied and a dancer, there was the top of you and the bottom of you were kind of integrated. That's not so much the case now. How do you deal with your upper body being fundamentally different than your lower body and trying to restore that sense of integrity and grace?
My upper body, it's my arms and my legs now. So I'm a lot stronger than I used to be. And there's a lot of tricks that you can do in order to seem one with the chair. So even though my legs are, you know, flopping around, I strap them to my chair so that when I do tricks or pop wheelies or and moving around the stage really quickly, I appear a lot more graceful than I would be if I didn't have the strap. So there's a lot of little tricks that I've been learning from my fellow dancers that have been in the company who have really been mentors to me.
Is part of your challenge as a dancer to convince people in the audience and people watching you that you are one with the chair?
I think my challenge is not so much to convince them that I'm one with the chair, but that I am a dancer. I think my goal on stage is just more to captivate the audience as an artist rather than bring my whole life story, my disability into the art, because just being on stage, being a disabled body on a stage is a radical act in itself. I don't want my identity as an artist to solely be dictated by my disability, which is very visible and I'm unable to hide it. However, as I continue dancing and exploring my movement, I want people to see the physicality and the strength that I've developed in this process.
Well, if I can shift and be a mentor now, you'll get over that. You won't worry about whether you're known just for your disability or not. It'll all mix together, and you'll make a very powerful statement as you explore the integrity of this whole experience, you know, and you'll age and you'll have different experiences and, you know, it's a huge vessel filling this life, even though you have a different physical shape.
I appreciate that. I know that day will come. Right now I'm also a musician, so I'm working on this project that is telling my story, and it's a similar story where right now I'm trying to tell my audience about my experience through this. However, I don't want that to be the only story. I don't want it to end there. So,
right. What do you think your future is as you move forward as an artist and whatever else you might do?
I want to continue dancing with Axis Dance Company and just continue to develop my physicality there. My real goal just as a personal artist, is to begin performing as a musician. My musical project is called Oniko, which is a play on words of Onward Ho. My friends didn't think that was catchy enough. But I've been working on it for the past 2.5 years, and I would love to just be a disabled musician out there playing and sharing my work, sharing my story, because there isn't enough of that. And I actually spent last weekend falling into a frigid swimming pool in a wedding dress for a music video, which I'm getting ready to release. And I think that it would be a really refreshing thing for the world to see.
Karina, may your leaps be high and your tires not be flat.
Thank you. Same to you.
Take care. Karina Ho is a dancer at the Axis Dance Company and a musician of the Oniko Project. Three years ago this week, a young man in Washington, D.C. got a big job.
May 10th, 1924, the day young J. Edgar Hoover became acting director.
He would take over a boring federal agency originally created to regulate buyers and sellers of oil and wheat trying to slip past regulators. But then, faced with the aftermath of the killing of President William McKinley in 1901, the country suddenly saw terrorists everywhere, and this little police force was ill-equipped. And by 1924, it was given the additional responsibility to enforce prohibition. Young J. Edgar Hoover had a free hand.
It is my belief that when a man becomes a part of this bureau, he must so conduct himself, both officially and unofficially, as to eliminate even the slightest possibility of criticism as to his conduct.
He was told, clean up this mess. And there was a mess, not only in the Bureau, but throughout the nation, where millions were revolting against the Prohibition Amendment in a mass disregard for the laws of the land.
FBI, fidelity, bravery, integrity.
What he created was part cult, part preserver of American values, all police force. Under the guise of chasing booze and bootleggers, J. Edgar Hoover made the FBI into a federal police force that would have horrified the original framers of the U.S. Constitution. It's now among the largest law enforcement agencies in the world. Hoover himself was an untouchable shadow president until his death, and his successors have all been mere shadows of that Hoover myth. The firing of James Comey reminds us of all that. In many ways, the FBI has become more than a federal police force. It's close to being a presidential police force. How that happened is the story told in G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century, the latest project of Beverly Gage. She's a professor of 20th century American history at Yale University.
Hoover was at the FBI for 48 years. So he came in as director in 1924, and he was actually there as the assistant director even before that. But he became director at the age of 29 in 1924, and he died in that same job in 1972 at the age of 77. During that period, the FBI, like the rest of the government, went through really enormous growth. And I think that when he came to the agency, nobody saw what was going to happen. So there weren't very many mechanisms in place to kind of constrain him or provide accountability for the FBI, and he was really able to create it in his own image.
So he created a personal police force that became among the largest in the world with a huge reputation, and he did it under the guise of prohibition and other sort of scares that were going on at the same time in America. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So when he came in as director in 1924, prohibition was in full swing. And already at that point, there were plenty of people in law enforcement who were thinking, uh-oh, this is not going to be a good ride. Hoover's main concern was actually that it was going to corrupt his agents, because he looked out at other police forces and saw them taking bribes and all sorts of shenanigans. So he tried to stay out of prohibition as much as he could. But of course, prohibition also produced a huge crime wave that by the 1930s is really what brought the FBI sort of in the wake of prohibition into national prominence when they began going after bank robbers and kidnappers in the 1930s, figures like John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd. That's really the moment that Hoover became a national figure.
And the way in which he fused that mission into popular culture and the way Hollywood embraced it, by the time we get to the 1950s and 60s, no American could imagine a United States without a Hoover-led investigative force called the FBI. Is that correct?
Hoover was absolutely this huge cultural figure and a major political influence in Washington. But everyone in the United States knew who J. Edgar Hoover was, knew what he stood for. Some people liked it and some people didn't. He was pretty popular for most of his career, which I think is hard for us to remember today since we mostly see him as this kind of villainous figure. But he was incredibly skilled at public relations and at getting his own ideas out into the press and also, as you say, into Hollywood and into popular culture.
The civil rights movement was eventually aided by the deployment of federal agents in places in the South that were unwilling to desegregate or follow the orders of the Civil Rights Act. But for a while, Hoover resisted the civil rights movement. And, that was a use of the police force to actually get in the way of freedom. How long did that last?
Yeah, the FBI had a very complicated record on civil rights in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. So Hoover died in 72. Hoover himself was really a very kind of conservative Southerner. I mean, he had been born in Washington, D.C., but he had come of age sort of in a segregationist world. And he himself, I think, really remained a product of that world. So he had lots of arguments about how and if the FBI wanted to engage in civil rights investigations. So there was a jurisdiction question before the Civil Rights Acts of the 50s and 60s. There really were questions about how federal power could be used in various crimes related to civil rights or in civil rights investigations altogether. After the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the FBI had this sort of paradoxical record in which it was pretty aggressively going after the Ku Klux Klan in the South, but it was also conducting widespread and often quite illegal surveillance operations against civil rights activists themselves. So most notably, in the early 60s, the FBI engaged in pretty widespread and really pretty outrageous campaign against Martin Luther King himself.
I'm wondering if in the absence of a Hoover character at the head of the FBI, that the agency runs the risk of becoming a presidential police force rather than a federal police force, and that someone with the, you know, personality, powerful personality of a Donald Trump could actually do what Hoover was able to do, but instead of from the bureau's office, from the White House. What do you think?
Hoover made his name in part on the claim that he was this independent, nonpartisan actor who had a lot of autonomy and could stand sort of outside of political pressures. Now, of course, for Hoover, that meant that he could kind of do what he wanted. And by the 1960s, people were beginning to think, it's probably not a great idea to have the same guy at the head of our powerful federal police force for half of a century. So in the 60s and then extending into the 70s, there were a whole new set of restrictions put in place about the FBI director's position and also what the FBI itself could do. So one of those is the 10-year limit that we now have on the FBI director. Others were things like the Freedom of Information Act, limits on FBI accountability, this intelligence committees. All of these pieces really came into place at the end of Hoover's life. And for the most part, those have obviously been incredibly beneficial. They came out of real crises about what an agency like the FBI was doing. But on the other hand, you are right that the FBI is now less of its own sort of independent institution and is probably a little more able to be buffeted by political winds, as we're seeing now.
Beverly Gage is a professor of 20th century history at Yale University. She's working on a book that will tell this story, G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover, and the American Century. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lots of history stirred up here, and we'd love to know what you think about it. Tell us about the Comey situation and anything else that makes you passionate. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.